thing, I think, after the marriage, a bit later, it looks in the papers that around December 1943, you're drafted. Can you tell us about the drafting procedure?
Yes, one day I was called over to go to the regulating office. I knew what a regulating office was by that time, and I'm sure I was going to get a draft. I'd been too long in barracks. And sure enough, I did. Now, I wasn't sure whether it was going to be a landing craft, having done the landing craft course, or whether, in fact, it was going to be some other ship. I thought, well, it's bound to be landing craft. I'll probably go on another course or something like that. But no, they told me, they gave me a travel warrant, told me to go to Tilbury.
Now, what was the procedure on being drafted? Was there anything special about it, or, you know?
No, they just gave me a travel warrant and said, go and report to HMS Gardner in Tilbury Docks. So I said, OK, I had no choice, and off I went. And when I got there, I found that there was a brand new destroyer waiting for me. Oh, I thought it was a destroyer. In fact, it was a Captain Class Frigate, so named by the Admiralty. It was an old-worlded ship, made in America, built in America. The Americans built 600 of them between 1943 and 1946. And we had 78 of these in the Royal Navy. They were on lease land, or lend lease, I think it was called. Get it the right way around. And they were all, as I said, they were all riveted. All welded. There wasn't a rivet in them. And I was rather puzzled actually going on my own because I thought there'd be a crew. But in actual fact, somebody had been taken ill, and so they got me as a replacement. I went on board, saw the master at arms, and he told me to report to the chief stoker, and I was taken down into the mess deck. And to my surprise, I found we didn't have to sleep. We'd been an American ship. We didn't sleep in our hammocks. We slept on bunks, and they were chained up to the wall, to the say the wall. I mean the side of the ship, the bulk, not the bulkhead, but the side of the ship. And so that there were lockers underneath. You would sit on the lockers, which acted as seats for the table where we had our meals.
But could you describe the mess deck and the bunk?
Yes. There were 30, I think there were 30 stokers altogether, because don't forget, there had been three watches. So there were never a whole contingent of stokers on the mess at any one time. But it was very small. I can't quite remember the size. All I know is that we were very, very cramped. And if you didn't put your bunk up and change it up, you couldn't sit at the table. I got the only bunk that was left, because obviously the rest of the crew had been over to America to collect the ship and done its running up trials and so on off Bermuda, and I hadn't taken part in any of that. And so the only bunk that was left was the third bunk up, which was the top bunk. And unfortunately, it was right over my feet, or depends which way I slept, or my head, there was a 500-watt light, which was never off. It was on 24 hours a day, and it was hot. So I either had a sweaty feet or a sweaty face. And it was bloody awful, but there was nothing I could do about
it. How did you find the generally bunk beds compared to hammocks, you know?
Oh, well, I much prefer the hammocks, to be honest.
No, why was that?
Well, they're more comfortable when you're rolling. It depends which way you sling them, you see. If you sling them fore and aft, you don't get the feel of the roll, but you do get the pitching. You know, pitching is up and down and rolling is side to side. You can have both at the same time as well. So if you slung it, we always slung our hammocks fore and aft, and this wasn't only when we had to do it, of course. The bunks were quite comfortable. We had a blanket, no sheets, of course. The Americans had sheets. Oh, the other thing that was interesting, why the ship was in Tilbury and not in its base in Liverpool, was because it had some engine failure. And it had to go into Tilbury to get the special equipment to repair whatever was wrong with it. I didn't know that at the time. And yes, the bunk beds. Well, there you are. I'm trying to work out the size of that. Now, I would say it was about Let's see. This is about 12 feet, about 14 feet wide, and about perhaps a bit wider, 15 feet, perhaps 15, 16 feet. And length was very different. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, 6, 24, about 24, 30 feet long, something like that. It's very difficult to remember, but it was about that, I think. Anyway, I got to know, they're not on leave, of course, but I got to know the chaps that
were
on.
So tell us about some of the lads you wrote. What were your first impressions of them, and how did you settle in with them? Because they'd been you've been living with these guys for nearly 2 years.
Yes. I got on pretty well with them as a whole. I was a rookie, of course, and we had some old salts in the mess, but most of us were rookies. So they'd only done the one trip, and of course they had that. I was right at the bottom of the ladder, so to speak, but I hadn't even done one trip. But they accepted me, okay, didn't have much trouble.
Were they the same sort of background yourself, or very different? Or
no, they were they hadn't had the type of education I had, which was very rugged. My education was, I went to 7 schools, as I probably mentioned earlier, because my parents were on the stage and moving about and one thing or another. And so it was very disjointed, but these were mostly good working class lads, which I can mix with very easily.
Did you have any special pals right at the start? Or
No, I didn't actually, although we did, as time went by, we went ashore with different people until we got to know them.
And we'll perhaps come back to that. Yeah. So your first start with your first impressions,
It was good. My first impressions were good.
What about the US sort of facilities? Have they been stripped out by then? I'm thinking of the laundry, the water cooler, and the rest of
it. Yes, they had been. The Admiralty wouldn't accept the ships as they were built completely by the Americans. For instance, the ice cream machine went out, the washing machine went out, clothes washing machine went out. We had to go back to Dobling in the bucket.
Uh-huh.
The steam pipe. We'd have a steam pipe down in the engine room and boil up the water with the dirty Nixon and wash them down like that. And what else did they take out? They took out the... one good thing they did take out, and that was the American lavatories. Because the Americans had a trough with running water all the time. And it was a three-holer. And he just sat there with no traditions at all between them. And we didn't fancy this very much. In fact, the Americans have told me since when I've been over there, they used to make little paper boats and set them alight, put them in the trough.
But they'd taken this stuff out. When you arrived, when you were on board the ship, this had all gone.
Yes, they had gone, and they had proper lavatories put in. Civilised ones, not like the Yanks trough. But they still didn't have doors on them. And they were pretty open to everything, but there you are. They were better. And what else did they take out? The washing machine, ice cream machine, I think that's about all. And I think the idea was they could get another depth charge or two in the space provided by removing these bits and pieces. So that was that. And then the repairs were done, we had to, the name of our skipper was Lieutenant Commander Bolton.
What was he like? What were your first impressions of him?
I never spoke to him. I spoke to him once. He was the most unusual man. He was, as far as I can gather, he was in civil life. He was a merchant navy skipper. And he was in the INVR. And he never, ever told us anything, which was most disconcerting, really, because some skippers, as soon as you got out of the 3-mile limit and they opened up their orders, used to come on the tunnel and say, well, boys, we're off to Timbuktu or wherever it was. But our skipper never told us anything. We got it on the bus, he never came on. And once I asked if I could take a photograph of him, I had my little camera, and he said no, and turned away. And I took the photograph of him, but of his back. Anyway, so I did take his photograph, but I still got it, but on his back. He must be long dead now, because he was much older than us. Anyway, when the repairs were done, we were off. But where to? Because the skipper never told us anything. We had the slightest idea. And until it came round on the bus that We were on our way to Liverpool. And when we got there, we went into Gladstone Dock.
No, well, hang on the way, you were seasick.
Oh, no, no.
Tell us about that.
Oh, I was not a good sailor. I was dreadfully seasick. And it was a bit grim, but not as seasick as I was going to be a bit later on. And I'll tell you why when I get there. We got to Liverpool, and we had, I don't know what we were doing there, we were waiting to be organised into convoys or escort groups. We had to join a group.
And which group did you join?
Well, we were in called the mixed group, which included corvettes, B&W destroyers, and we also, to start with, in B3 group, which was just purely DEs, as we affectionately called them, company class frigates.
So you pulled into Gladstone Dock.
We pulled into Gladstone Dock.
What was it like there?
Well, I immediately telephoned my wife, and oh no, I'd already telephoned and told her I was going to Liverpool, so I must have known somehow. Oh, I must tell you about that. That's very interesting. And she was waiting for me because she still had the. She was got demobbed by that time, and she was pregnant. I've forgotten what I was going to say now.
You were talking about when you arrived, that she was there, how she knew was a story.
Yes. We had a system which was very, very good. I wanted to know, she wanted to know where I was at any time in writing to her. And of course, it would be censored. Our letters were censored by the First Lieutenant. And so when I was at home, I said, well, what I'll do, I'll write to you. And this is a code we thought up. If I put my darling, that would be Newfoundland. If I put dearest, that would be South America. And I had a whole list like that. Hello, sweetheart, would be another one. And that would be Gibraltar. And so on and so on. So I had about 20 or 30 of these. So that she always, when I wrote to her and got mine, she always knew where I'd been. Well, I was there, and so it was a good little system, it worked very well. Never got blue penciled as it used to be. Good. Used to quit blue penciling during the war, essentially, put the blue pencil through things. And I suppose we must have ammunitioned up there in Dresden. It didn't concern me because I had an engine room, and I was busy learning about the engine room.
Now, what were you learning? How was the Well, first, tell us about the watch system first.
The watch system, well, when we set off at last, after refueling and other things that we had to do, we were put into three watches. And they were for the morning watch, which was from 4 in the morning until 8 o'clock. And that's 4-hour watches. Then there was the forenoon watch, which was from 8 o'clock to 12. Then there's the afternoon watch, which was from 12 to 4. And then they had what's called the two dog watches, which was 2 hours each. The first dog was 2 hours, from 4 to 6. And the last dog, it was never called the second dog, last dog, which was from 6 to 8. Then there was the... I'm losing it.
The
evening watch, I don't know.
Well, it says first and middle watch and morning watch.
Yes, well, the middle watch was the worst of the lot. That was from 12 to 4. The morning watch was from 4 to 8.
That's the way we started, yes.
Yes, I got it pretty well. So you're in three watches. The reason why one watch was split into 2 hours each is that so you never got the same watches all the time. By splitting like that, they varied. So that some poor devil didn't have the middle watch, which would be all hated all the time. Well, we set off, and I discovered we were going to meet the convoy at a place called Moville, off Moville, which is a town in the north of Ireland, but not in the Free States, in that top left hand corner, if you look at the map. And that's where the convoy is assembled. The ones coming from south, from Southampton, the ones coming from North Scotland, Clyde, and so on. And they used to assemble there, getting ready to make their way across the Atlantic, North Atlantic. Well, now, sickness. When we got out of the Mersey, it was a bit rough. And oh boy, was I sick. I used to lie down in the on the plates in the engine room, the smell of the thudding noise. You couldn't speak though, and the engines were so loud. There was a little box that you put your head in with a telephone. It had perforations in it to absorb noise, and you had to speak. Two of you put your head in this, and I had a leading stoker with me, who was in charge of the engine room, and myself, and he told me what to do, and so on. And so we got out into the open sea, and how was I? I wish
how bad was it?
Well, it was very bad. Those ships, as they say, would roll on a wet flannel. And when I first went down the engine room, we were right out at sea after a few hours after leaving Liverpool. And I saw the sides going in and out, sides of the ship. And I said to the chief stoker, actually, who was there at the time, who was showing me around, says, "Oh, don't worry about that, lad. If they didn't move, they'd split open and we'd all be in trouble." That does that with welded steel sheets. So that didn't feed me very much. Anyway, I felt that I just wanted to die, couldn't have cared less. I was lying on the bilge, around the plates, spewing into the bilges, and the leading stoker would come along, give me a little kick, and say, "Come on, you've got your job to do." I had to get up and stagger around, taking readings of thermometers.
Well, you were warned not to be sick. To be sick, you had to be sick in the bilges, didn't you?
It was very dangerous if you were sick on the plates, because you slide, you can kill yourself. Ship rolling, you trod on a load of vomit, you ended up in the bilges yourself. It wasn't very clever.
So how long were you bad like this?
Well, what happened was I was bad for about 3 weeks, and then I said, to my surprise, I stopped being sick. And I found that every time we left harbour, I used to have a nasty taste in my mouth, a bit of a headache for the first 24 hours, and then it went, and I was okay. But I'd also discovered that if you change ships, which you often had to, you know, if people moved about, you were sick all over again, because each ship has a slightly different motion that affects your stability.
Now tell me a bit more about the rolling, because they were famous for rolling the captain.
Yeah, there were circumstances. When they rolled in all circumstances, there weren't any normal ones. Every type thing was different. You pitched and you the difference between rolling and pitching and tossing, you know, pitching is up and down, you leave your stomach down there, it's like in a very fast lift, and you go up and your stomach's still down there, and as you come back down again, your stomach shoots up. And it's very much like that. And then you can have rolling at the same time. And it was just grim. Everything got broken, cut from sources, and everything was wet because sea came down the hatches, clothes were wet, and it was a pretty miserable time. You had to learn how to keep dry. We had the best job of the lot, of course, in the engine room.
What was your job? I mean, we've talked about the watches. What were your duties in the engine room?
Well, because it was a diesel electric, there didn't seem to be many. The officer of the watch on the bridge used to ring down resolutions, and you had to move these dials to, for instance, he would 478 would come up and you were 479, so you had to turn one knob down 1 degree and so on. Now, he did that in the middle of the watch when he's, you know, from midnight to 4 o'clock in the morning, make sure you're awake, and normally it's several degrees and so on. And then you had to take the temperatures. Everything had there were four 16 cylinder Grey Marine engines and one 12 cylinder. The 12 cylinder was for auxiliary lighting and things, and when you're in harbour. The noise they made was indescribable. How I didn't go deaf, I have no idea. That's where I would have been deaf by now. And one had to, because it was, there's no shoveling coal, we were told it was a product of the old days being called a stoker. We weren't shoveling coal. What were we doing? We had forms to fill up with temperature readings. You went round the engine and you looked at these temperature gauges and you wrote down what the temperature was. And then you showed it to the leading hand, who was one above you, He noted that everything was all right, and so it went on like that. And then just keeping a general eye on things, making sure that the bridge was responded to immediately with resolutions and so on. It didn't
sound much.
It wasn't much, really.
What about cleaning?
It's down at sea waste. I'm going to tell you a story about cleaning. Let's see.
We'll leave it till then. You went out long before you had a bit of an emergency when someone went overboard. Do you want to tell that story?
Oh, that was in the IEC. Oh, yes, there was a great kerfuffle. I happened to be on watch. But the instructor said, stick your head out of the hatch, see what's going on. So I did a little bit more and I came on from the upper deck, which I shouldn't have done because I was on watch, but no one said to why. They were so concerned about this chap. He'd gone over the side and he had leather sea boots on and he had a big duffel coat on. And we tried to get him back in again. The skipper slowed the ship down to stuff a ship in wartime with dynamite because, you were sitting duck. They tried to get him with a boat hook, but he kept ripping his clothes. But I last saw him. Oh, a chap went down the ladder. There's a ladder down the side of the ship, steel ladder that's welded onto the side of the ship. He went down, holding on with one hand. He grabbed hold of the chap with the other, but couldn't hold him. He was so full of water, with his duffel coat on these boots, and he just pulled it away. And he must have been already dead, because I saw him floating away, face downwards. And the chap who went down the ladder was amazing, because he fell in as well. And he came up, believe it or not, and this is perfectly true, on the other side of the ship. He came up on the other side of the ship, he came up just where the ladder was, on the other ladder, on that side of the ship, and pulled himself out. It was a miracle. So they didn't stop to pick a dead body up, and so he floated away, and that was it. And we were going to Gibraltar at the time, and when we got
that wasn't on the first convoy, then.
No, it was, I think, the second convoy.
Okay, well, that's not too out of line.
No. What happened was, it's tradition in the Navy, if someone dies in those sort of circumstances, that his kit is auctioned, and the money that you get from his kit goes to his dependents. I mean, silly things like his toothbrush and so on were going for £1, and so a quid was £1 a lot of money, which wages to me. You know, and we did what we could. And that was the end of that lad. Anyway, the sequel to that was everybody had to have a rope round. From then on, the skipper insisted everyone tied a rope round their waist, especially made with a loop on it. Seamen made these ropes so that it could be hooked in by this loop. And also, they put a wire hawser from along the upper deck, about six feet from the deck, all the way from fore to aft, with handles on it, a bit like the underground things you hang on the tube, you know. And they slid along this, so anyone coming on the upper deck always had to grab one of these and slide it along if he was going from one side end of the ship to the other. We didn't lose anyone after that.
Now, on this first convoy, anything happened? This was out to Newfoundland, I think. Mobile, yeah.
Yes, and we eventually, after a week or so, I forget how long it took actually, I can't remember. They vary so much, I'll tell you why later. The convoy, of course, was made up of all sorts of different types of ships, and you had to go as the slowest ship. I mean, there's no good the convoy was splitting up. They had to keep together. It was very important, but you couldn't go faster than the slowest ship. These convoys didn't move very quickly. And eventually we got across without any mishaps to St. John's. The convoy disappeared. I think it went up the Labrador coast and down to the other way, down into America, and so on. And we went ashore for a couple of days. We were in the harbour for a couple of days, and perhaps even longer, and we went ashore. There was nothing there, though. St. John's was dead in the life hole. And the Newfoundlanders didn't like us. And I asked one, why are we so unpopular? so they like the Irish. And his reply was, well, just before the war, you can see what our capital is like, St John's, Newfoundland. It's a dump. And he said, just before the war, we asked the British government for a loan of, I think it was £250,000 to build a hospital. And it was refused. And with the other hand, you lent Germany £9 million. It's in 1937, I think, or 38. He said, you can understand why we're not very happy with you. And I was surprised to get an answer like that, quite frankly. And I felt sorry for the not GI brides, because there's a big Newfoundland brides who were coming out, had no idea what it's going to be like. It's pretty grim, that coast. You get lots of fogs off the levers or banks and so on. And I certainly wouldn't like to live in Newfoundland. It was our oldest colony, by the way. Did you know that? And it's now part of Canada. After the war, it was succeeded to Canada.